it's at, folks, here, allthingstrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
So, oh man, intelligence.
Intelligence? What about it?
Intelligence. There's not a whole lot of it.
Well, are we just jumping right into the topic today? We're not gonna do some unrelated talking.
No, I wasn't
first.
Jumping directly into it. You immediately thought we were, weren't you?
That is.
So you're demonstrating my point.
Oh, okay. Well, what
See
were
what
you
I did there?
What did you mean, Bob?
I laid an elaborate trap, is what I did.
Yeah, you did. And I failed my mind reflex save to avoid it. Walked right into that one.
That's exactly right.
What I've been noticing is that everyone is playing Skyrim except me. I don't play Skyrim.
Well, who's everybody?
Everyone. I can only think of one other person right now who I actually know isn't playing Skyrim.
Dude, that's exciting. Who's that?
Johan from work.
Johan. And, that's true.
Yeah, I know he isn't playing it. I guess some of the other people in the warehouse aren't playing it, but most of them are. And all of my friends are playing it. Like,
Skyrim's so rad.
Literally all of my friends.
Skyrim's so good.
I believe you. I just don't feel like spending $60 on a game that I may not finish.
I don't blame you. For not wanting to spend $60.
Yeah, instead, I spent $10 on a game called Avedon: The Black Fortress, which is this awesome like retro 2D RPG. I actually really like it. It's got an
Please go into detail, because I'm sure no one knows what you're talking about.
No, it's a little mini game. It's made by Spider Software. It's like, you know, old school Baldur's Gate style games. It's fairly simple.
Actually, reminded me a lot of Icewind Dale.
I never played Icewind Dale, but I could totally see that. And it's got an interesting world. The weird thing is that it has four classes. You can either play a sorceress, a blade master, a thief, or I forget what it's like, a shadow master or whatever, but it's basically a thief, or a druid, or a shaman, I think they're called. So you have one of each class. But the weird thing is that the computer, the game then gives you an NPC of each of those classes. And you can only ever
just to fill out the roster.
Yeah, so like those are your party members. It's one of each class. You get four of them, so you end up with redundancy. And so there's like one character,
no matter what,
one character you won't use a whole lot because you're just that class. And there isn't a whole lot of variation between the classes, like, you know, within each class. You can decide to make your sorcerer blasty or, you know, cursey, but in the end, you'll kind of end up with the same thing once you get to higher levels. And sometimes that's good. Sometimes I like to have two sorceresses. But for the most part, that means I don't use the sorceress NPC a whole lot, even though she's really interesting, because I'm also a sorceress.
But can you join the Imperials or the Stormcloaks?
None of that. All right. Well, referencing back to the trap that Bob laid for me earlier, we are talking about the intelligence world and spying and espionage in Star Trek.
Oh, man. I feel like we need, like, a James Bond drop-in.
Well, maybe we could do that instead of the StarCraft intro. We could use the James Bond intro.
Excellent, but then everyone's gonna know about that ahead of time.
Yeah, all right.
Before we talk about
it. Well, this message is from the past. but so there's a couple of challenges when you're doing espionage in any kind of space opera setting with different species, and that is everyone looks different.
Yep.
And this is a problem in regular espionage, too.
What just looks different? Their biology is all different, too.
Well,
when you
right.
scan them.
You know, different customs, different languages. Different language is not so much a problem in Star Trek. But, you know, in real espionage, it's often one of the biggest obstacles to infiltrating someone is finding someone of that nationality and ethnicity to do the infiltrating. You know, it's kind of hard for an American to infiltrate, say, Al-Qaeda, just off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there are some pretty obvious differences there. And it's the same thing. I mean,
what are you trying to say, Orin? Are all Americans white or something? What are you saying?
I'm saying that the average American is white and is, you know, isn't going to know all the things he's going to need to know to infiltrate Al-Qaeda. So, you know, it's obviously not insurmountable. We have infiltrated other, you know, nationalities and ethnicities, but it is something that makes things more difficult, even between powers that are, like, you know, the same skin color, like, say, Russia and the United States. It's sort of a problem. And in Star Trek, it's way worse because everyone is, like, completely different looking, and they kind of get around that somewhat by, like, super cosmetic surgery.
The super cosmetic surgery.
Which is, you know, where they take the actor and they put the makeup for a different alien on him.
yeah?
And you see that in, I forgot to write down the name of this episode. This is my favorite one. Is the one where Sisko, Odo, Worf, and O'Brien are sent to infiltrate, you know,
Apocalypse something.
Is that what it's called?
Apocalypse Rising or Apocalypse
yeah.
Now, something
and
like that.
And they basically all get surgically altered to look like Klingons. And this is during Odo's human phase, where he's actually been trapped in human form and he's all depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And, like...
That was, like, the episode just before, wasn't it? Where that happened.
Was it? Was it only one episode afterwards?
I think so.
I just know that arc is not one of my favorite arcs in DS9. But, you know, you could see, like, you know, obviously Avery Brooks makes a rad-looking Klingon. Not so much Odo.
Klingons speak proud to one another!
Yeah, Odo is not so much a good Klingon. Rajay Abernathy, I think is his name. Rene Abernathy. He is not a great Klingon.
It was a J, not a K. Rene Auberginois.
Okay. I'm an uncultured ingrate.
Yes.
But, also, I wanted to mention something real quick. As part of my research, for this episode, I discovered, because I was trying to look up the, one of the episodes that has Kira and Dukat in it, I discovered that if you type Kira space space D for, you know, if you're starting to type Dukat into Google, it will autofill in Kira Dukat fanfiction. That's like the first thing that comes up.
Fiction or slash fiction?
It says fanfiction, Kira Dukat fanfiction.
Alright.
Yeah, this is the first thing that comes up. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Alright.
But once you get
take that for what you will, audience.
Yeah. Once you get past the different species barriers, and it's nice that everyone's a humanoid, because you can surgically alter a human to look like a Klingon. It'd be kind of hard to surgically alter a human to look like a floating ball of gas.
Or a Tholian.
Or a Tholian, which when we finally see the Tholians, they're like big insects.
Yep. That love the heat.
Yeah. And I would like, hate to be know, live in an environment.
I would hate to be a part of the Tholian. Like, counterintelligence ring for, like, Starfleet or something. I would hate that job.
And, like, or you know, just even being, like, the human ambassador to the Tholians.
Yes, that would suck, too.
But once you get past that, there's still the fact that in space, things are awfully far apart. And it's kind of hard, you know, like, it's, you know, just to say, like, dropping an agent into Russia is no small feat, and then retrieving them. But, you know, now you have to do it across, like, interstellar distances.
If there's one thing Call of Duty Black Ops taught me is that nothing is impossible when you want to get into Russia.
Oh, well, I mean,
Blackbird parachute out at, like, a bajillion feet, we got this.
You know, Russia is, Russia, for some reason, is the new Germany, even though, like, we're not actually, you know, militarily opposed with them anymore. All the modern shooters now are about Russia. Russia is either invading us or we are invading them.
Which is really weird, because I think China is much more.
Yeah, China is way more up in our face than Russia is right now. But I actually I read an article
as of this recording anyway.
Yeah, I read an article on that talked about how the reason why China isn't featured as the bad guy in most of our games is because so many of our companies depend on Chinese business deals.
I can see that.
And apparently the. There was a god. What video game? Oh, it was a remake of Red Dawn. I think is it the one where the old movie where like these kids are hiking.
You're talking about Homefront.
Yeah, it was
the movie was Red Dawn. Yeah, and then there was a game that was called Homefront, which was originally going to be the Chinese, but they changed it to the North Koreans.
Yeah, they changed it to the North Koreans at like the
which
final
you know
hour
much more likely
because they didn't want to piss off all of their Chinese business associates, which is you know a fair point. But anyway, so you have all these problems, and you have. In Star Trek, the various superpowers sort of edge towards one kind of overarching intelligence agency, whereas, like, in real life, we typically have at least two, you know, one to handle offensive intelligence gathering and one for defensive intelligence gathering, and we actually have way more than that, but, you know, we typically, our two biggest intelligence networks are going to be offensive and defensive. We have the CIA for offensive and the FBI for defensive. Britain has MI6. And MI5, I forget what the Israeli equivalent is called, but you know most of the
Mossad,
yeah, the Mossad. But I forget if that's their offense. I think that's their offensive one. I forget what their defensive one is called. I just know that they're part of their training of a Mossad agent is they have to try to infiltrate Israel, and the Israeli counterintelligence people are not told that they're Israelis in disguise.
I thought Mossad was the Israeli.
It is the Mossad. Like the Mossad is Israel's offensive intelligence network. And so part of Mossad training is that they have to infiltrate Israel.
What?
That's the thing. They are sent to spy on Israel as part of their training. And so they have to spy on whatever the defensive intelligence network is called. I forget what it is. And the people they're spying on are not told that they're trainees. As far as they know, they're just spies.
All right.
I assume it happens on a really...
I suppose this is a really good way to root out the bad candidates right off the bat.
I mean, I assume this takes place under at least some kind of controlled circumstances, but I know that very often Mossad agents get, like, interrogated and have the shit beaten out of them during training by the Israeli government that thinks they're trying to spy on it.
Wow.
But anyway, so, the intelligence...
That's blowing my mind. That's...
I know, right?
I mean, I read a lot of Tom Clancy and such. Well, wow.
Yeah, the intelligence world is pretty hardcore, and a lot of it's weird and mysterious by its very nature, because we don't get to know a whole lot about it.
Uh-huh.
But in Star Trek, we have the two most prominent ones are probably the Tal Shiar and the Obsidian Order, for the Romulans and the Cardassians, respectively. And for all intents and purposes, these could basically be the same organization in terms of the way they operate. They're both basically the KGB, because, you know, during the Cold War, there was, like, Russia had this setup where it was a kind of a trifecta, where you had the three major powers were the Kremlin, you know, and the civilian government, the Red Army, and the KGB.
Mm-hmm.
And the power sharing deal kind of worked as that the civilian government controlled who got the positions and made legislation. The Red Army had all the guns, and the KGB had dirt on everyone. Mm-hmm. So that was completely oversimplified the situation. That was what was going on. And that's basically the same situation you have with the Tal Shiar and the Obsidian Order. And we get to see way more of it developed with the Obsidian Order, where you have the Central Command, the Obsidian Order, and the D'Etapa Council. And the Central Command is, of course, the military. The D'Etapa Council are, of course, the civilians.
Was the D'Etapa Council always a thing?
Yeah, it was always around. It was just kind of impotent until the fall of the Obsidian Order, which then led to the civilian uprising, which restored power to the D'Etapa Council.
Mm-hmm.
But it was already it was first mentioned, I think, in the episode with the child wrangling custody in Deep Space Nine, where there's like this Cardassian orphan who's being raised by Bajorans, and there's this big convoluted plot by Dukat to embarrass one of his rivals.
It's just called Cardassians, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that is. It's just called Cardassians. And it's this big plot where, like, the child is actually the long-lost son of an important D'Etapa Council. Anyway, he's part of the civilian government. He's very important. He's a legate, and he's one of Dukat's enemies. And so that's where we first hear about the D'Etapa Council. But it's implied that what they think didn't actually matter too much until the civilian rule was reinstated right before the Klingon invasion.
The figure, right?
Which is, you know, great precedent to set there. and, of course, we see the same thing with the Tal Shiar in The Face of the Enemy, which is the episode where Troy is kidnapped and surgically altered to look like a Romulan to help dissidents sneak out. That's a badass episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the only times Troy gets to be cool as Troy and not having to be somebody else. And in that episode, we see that because she's impersonating a Tal Shiar agent, we see that the way that the Tal Shiar and the military interact, which is that they both recognize the need for each other, but they don't like each other at all, and there are serious friction issues. And we also see that both the Obsidian Order and the Tal Shiar both fulfill the other role of an intelligence agency, which is that they are secret police, and they spy on everybody. Like, they spy on Romulans and Cardassians, respectively, to make sure that there's no dissent. And there are a couple of episodes where, like...
Gestapo say what?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, you know, in the episode Unification, Picard and Data are, like, snooping around Romulus, and, like, the soup shop owner that they go into assumes, because they're asking questions about someone, that they must be from the Tal Shiar, and gives them free soup and talks about how she's an awesome patriot, and that they don't have to arrest her.
Yep.
Which is, you know, kind of represents the downside of having everyone so afraid of you that they won't question your motives at all.
Nope.
Because it's like, I am from the Tal Shiar, and I will need you to hand over all of your underwear. And it's like, well, that sounds really dumb, but
I'm a patriot, here you go.
he said he was from the Tal Shiar, so I can't, you know, question him, because I might die.
Because I might die.
Even though I don't know for a fact that he's from the Tal Shiar, he just said Tal Shiar, and that's like a magic word. This is sort of the same thing with the Obsidian Order, and the Obsidian Order was first actually named in The Wire, which is the episode where it's early in the first season, it's revealed that Garak actually has an implant in his brain, which is supposed to be used to resist torture, which basically floods him with pleasure chemicals.
Yep.
And that apparently life on the station sucks so bad that he eventually just turned it on.
All the time.
Left it on forever. And then it started to break down and he was like super addicted to it. And Bashir has to help him through that whole thing.
Yep.
And that was also the first time we met Inabram Tane, the officially former head of the Order. Big air quotes around former.
Yep.
Because, apparently no one in the Obsidian Order ever actually retires. And then, of course, sadly, they were destroyed in the Dias Cast, which is the one where the combined, the Tal Shiar and the Obsidian Order build a fleet and try to invade the Founders, and that doesn't go very well.
Yep.
Which is weird because, apparently the Obsidian Order was destroyed, but the Tal Shiar apparently got away just fine. I guess maybe the Obsidian Order just sunk more of their resources into it. They just cared more.
But if I had to pit the resources of the Romulan Empire versus the Cardassian Empire, I think the Romulans have the Cardassians beat.
Oh, well, obviously. I think it was interesting that because of that incident, the Obsidian Order fell apart. I got the impression that the reason for that was because the Order had no clear line of succession, because it seems like the Order is, in the Obsidian Order, you advance by killing whoever's above you, seems to be the implication.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the implication that Garrick gave when he was talking about it.
I know Cardassian society kind of works in the fashion that where, your family has enemies or some such, or you personally have enemies, but I wouldn't think that assassination would be the way to go to, advance your rank.
Well, it's basically
at least within the Obsidian Order, anyway.
Well, it seems like with the Order, the impression that I got was that it's basically the current head of the Order's job to decide who his successor is going to be. And once you decide who your successor is going to be, you have to be someone you really trust, because then obviously they're in a position to want to get rid of you so they can be the head faster.
Right.
And it seems like the implication was that Garrick was going to be Tame's successor, but then something happened. And we never find out what. Never, ever in the history, in all of Deep Space Nine, do they explain to us what happened. But then Tame changed his mind and exiled Garrick. I really wanted to know.
Got the whole spiel where he was talking about his friend Elam.
No, those were all lies.
Are you sure?
And they were all true. That's,
thanks,
as,
Orin.
As Garrick said, they were all true. And who knows what the hell that means, but we never actually found out concretely what the information... And remember, Elam is Garrick's first name.
Right.
Right, so, and it was all, that was during his old drug hallucination thing. And I assume that when he said they're all true, that they were, aspects of them were true, but I assume he was never actually on Bajor as a military officer. That doesn't sound like something that Garrick was doing.
Undercover.
I don't know what Garrick, an extremely high-ranking member of the Obsidian Order would be doing on Bajor. What could he possibly have been doing there? Who was he spying on? I don't think the Bajorans merited that level of intelligence gathering. We do know he spied on the Romulans for a bit. He was a gardener.
He was a gardener.
And Garrick is basically the world's greatest spy, which we'll get to a little bit later. But I don't want to take this entire time just talking about how the Obsidian Order works. But I got the impression that the reason why the Obsidian Order wasn't able to survive the massacre in the Dias Cast is that once Tane was dead, they had no leadership. And so all of them sort of turned trying to protect themselves from their enemies and, in Central Command and the D'Etapa Council. And the whole thing kind of fell apart from there. Whereas the Tal Shiar, also I imagine the head of the Tal Shiar wasn't actually with that fleet.
There.
But the Tal Shiar seemed to have a more structured format and less of a, handshake, backroom deal sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But moving on from them, I wanted to take a moment to talk about Klingon intelligence, which, we never actually find out if it has a name, if it has a badass name, or if it's just Klingon intelligence.
Uh-huh.
And we don't really know anything about how they're structured. Bob, I think you posed a theory about how you think they work.
Really, honestly, because of the way Klingon society is structured, where it's like a bunch of great houses,
yeah.
I really think that keeping in, true space Viking tradition, they just pretty much just buy information is what they do.
Mm-hmm.
I really honestly think that's how they gain their information.
Yeah, that would make sense.
They piece together as they go.
I could imagine them buying it from, the Orion Syndicate and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, granted, we only ever really see mostly the warrior cast of Klingon society put forward. We rarely see anyone from anywhere else. We see, maybe a doctor from Enterprise, and then there's Jadan, which is also a doctor from TNG, during the Drumhead.
The lawyer. Do you
remember? What?
No, the lawyer from, I forget the name of the episode, but it's the one where Worf is on trial for blowing up a Klingon transport full of civilians.
Oh, yeah.
I forget his name, but, Klingon lawyer.
Klingon D-bag number four.
Yeah. That guy was an ass. But yeah. I did like him. I have almost universally liked all the non-warrior Klingons.
So I really think the primary source for information for the Klingons is pretty much the leaders of the houses buying information from whatever source they can.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, there's the overarching, you know, Imperial Defense Force, right, mm-hmm. for the Empire, right? So they probably have their own intelligence service of some sort, but I really don't think that it's really any better.
Right. I would say that of the great powers, the Klingons are probably the least well endowed, you know, intelligence network speaking. But there is one episode I wanted to mention, I forgot to write down the name of this one. I think it's Visionary. That's what it is. And the episode is actually about O'Brien time traveling and dying of radiation poisoning. Because, you know, it's not a Deep Space Nine episode if we don't fuck with O'Brien.
When he time travels, dies of radiation. I don't think I know this one.
Okay, so the top of my head. Okay, anyway. The plot of this episode of Visionary is that he's like time shifting, and he'll like shift forward in time a little bit and like see what's going on, and then shift back.
Mm. Okay, now.
And as this is happening, he's being poisoned. He's like the time shifting is poisoning him with radiation.
Yeah, he sees himself a couple times. And...
Right, but a side plot is that there are a bunch of like rowdy, drunken Klingons on the station from a freighter. And then it turns out they're actually spies. They're Klingon spies. And their cover story is that they're just regular Klingons. And, like, the idea being that, like, Klingons are supposed to be, like, rowdy and loud and drunk. And people kind of think of them as being kind of stupid and not, like, you know, up for plotting and complex conniving. So, like, no one really pays any attention to them or mm-hmm. what they're doing. Because they're just like, oh, it's Klingons, whatever. As long as they're not shoving a batleth in your face, you're fine.
Yep.
Which I thought was just I thought that was a great cover story. And we also know from Return to Grace, apparently they were able to... Return to Grace is the episode where Dukat is flying a freighter and has to take on a bird of prey. And in that episode,
But they had the giant laser cannon from the station. You don't understand.
Yes, they did. But in that episode, they...
it's like sifting through the wreckage of the Death Star. Like putting the giant laser like on the cruiser.
Well, it was actually from the planet, but yeah. But in that episode, Dukat mentions that the Klingons are attacking an outpost that officially has nothing on it, but unofficially is actually a weapons development station. And he's like, you know, apparently their intelligence network is good enough that they know where it is and that it was there. So apparently they've got something going on. And even though you weren't dealing with the Obsidian Order anymore, I still imagine that the Cardassian security is still fairly tight.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Klingon intelligence, that's about all there is to be said about them. I imagine
that there's not much of it. Oh, snap.
The primary form of Klingons preventing people from infiltrating them is that anyone trying to infiltrate the Klingons has to be a Klingon, which is really hard, because, like, you know, you can get challenged to a fight to the death at any moment.
Any moment, you may be challenged.
And if you do the wrong thing, bad stuff will happen.
The way you walk offends my honor.
And then, then we have Dominion intelligence. Which is basically just changelings, from what I can tell. And, you know, the changelings are basically the ultimate infiltrators, because other than Odo, they can all...
Well, there was... I mean, literally, in the last episode of Season 2, Jem'Hadar is what it's called,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Vorta is just sitting there helpless, right? Or not sitting there helpless, she's actually running through the forest, right? And it's his first contact with, you know, at least Sisko, anyway. I don't know what the Federation, supposedly vessels were lost in the Gamma Quadrant or whatever already. Mm-hmm. At this point.
Official first contact.
Yeah. So, that seems like one of their intelligence means is actually having, you know, helpless Vorta run away from Jem'Hadar.
Yeah, I always took that as an opportunistic thing, because, like, anyone that the Dominion would have run into normally would know what a Vorta was. Mm-hmm. Anyone in the Gamma Quadrant would know what a Vorta is and be like, hey, you're an agent of the Dominion.
Hey.
But because the Federation are from, like, across the galaxy, they've never seen a Vorta. They don't know what a Vorta looks like.
Because, you know, camping trips on the other side of the galaxy are always a good thing.
Right, exactly.
It's a great idea.
So I never thought that the Vorta would be routinely used for intelligence gathering. Or maybe for their less important missions, they do, like, surgically altered Vorta. But Vorta are very, I don't know, a lot of the Vorta that we meet are, like, place their own survival above the good of the Dominion, I've noticed, which is kind of weird considering how, like, good they were at making the Jem'Hadar or the ultimate soldiers. Then they have the Vorta, who are kind of, like, not really all that great at serving the interests of the Founders. Not always, but some of them are, like, you know, really eager to do whatever has to be done to save themselves. But Anyway, that aside, when they're doing the important stuff, they use changelings, who can, you know, become anyone or anything and are basically undetectable. And, you know, they came up with the whole blood test thing, but that has never actually worked. The blood test has never actually revealed a changeling or shown any sign that it was even impeding their progress.
Yep.
So yeah, the changelings are basically just major cheaters because they can do whatever they want.
Uh-huh.
Although, this does bring up an interesting point I'm about to talk about, which is the Federation's intelligence. And of course we have Starfleet intelligence from all we can tell is basically a boring intelligence agency that never does anything bad.
A boring intelligence agency.
Well, cause you know, bad. I mean, like, they can't really do any kind of skullduggery because that would be against the morals of the Federation, right? Which is why, drumroll, Section 31 exists.
Bam!
And for those of you who haven't seen enough Deep Space Nine, they know what I'm talking about. Section 31 is a super secret intelligence network agency that was created in the original Federation Charter and that no one knows about. It's like so secret that people don't even know what it is. And they basically, their whole idea is to protect the Federation way of life by any means necessary. So they don't care about Federation principles.
Literally,
they
any
will,
means.
Yeah, they will violate those principles to their heart's content if they think it's serving the Federation.
Yep.
They were created in Inquisition, which is an episode where Bashir, supposedly the episode is about how Bashir is on trial because they think he's a Dominion agent.
They're not on trial. Sloan comes to the station and is like, you know, oh man, we're doing these interviews. Mm-hmm. Is what happens. No one's on trial quite yet.
Right.
They never get on trial anyway. I mean, all the while, Bashir is actually being evaluated by Sloan and a couple of his, you know, compatriots.
Right, and,
you know,
to be
like a Section 31 agent.
Yeah, the big reveal is that they were actually looking to recruit him.
We were on the holodeck the whole time.
Yep. Oh dear. Which is actually kind of struck me as a little weird that like they basically just showed up and explained what Section 31 was, and then he said no, and they just let him walk away.
Cause, they didn't though.
Yeah, they totally did.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they did.
It's an arm of Silent Legus.
Well, I mean, they came back
they
later.
Him.
They used him later, but the point is that they were very careless with like just throwing around the fact of their existence and what they are. And like, especially considering that like the very existence of Section 31 being this huge secret is a huge advantage to them. And suddenly they're just telling people about it, like people who they don't know for sure are going to join them and end up not joining them. Like, I don't know, it just seems like they would, I mean, obviously, there's even, like, precedent for a memory erasing device in Star Trek. Made me wonder why they didn't use that. But even if that device didn't exist, it seems like they would have some kind of contingency in place for what to do.
Bashir.
Or just maybe not blab to him about the whole thing. Just be like, hey, this is a super advanced branch of Starfleet intelligence. And, you know, that way all he'd know is that some advanced branch of Starfleet intelligence contacted him, as opposed to giving him the whole kit and caboodle right out of the base and just being like, this is what we are, this is what our mission statement is. By the way, no one knows about us, please don't tell. Okay, thanks. Because then, of course,
Bashir goes and tells.
Yeah, Bashir goes and immediately tells everyone he knows and makes his Facebook status, hey guys, I was attempted to be recruited by Section 31. And a bunch of people asked him, what was Section 31? And he made a note about what Section 31 was. Okay, sorry. Facebook. I'm talking about Facebook now.
It fits. It's cool.
But yeah, it seems like a huge security breach is what I'm saying. And I guess, and to get a little deeper into Section 31, if the Tal Shiar and the Obsidian Order are KGB,
sorta. I mean, you can go today into some today's conspiracies, like the Majestic 12, mm-hmm. right? Or Majestic 12, excuse me. You know what that is?
Yeah, I know Majestic 12.
Some people say that doesn't exist. You know,
well, it doesn't. Most people say it doesn't exist. There are a few people who say it does. For reference, the Majestic 12 is a supposed group of people that, as far as I can, like, I think there are some supposed documents that talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think they were supposedly commissioned by Truman in 1954, as I recall.
I don't remember.
That's what the documents supposedly say. But I actually did some research on this, and the documents are supposedly pretty obviously fakes. Like, they're supposed to be FBI internal memos, but they don't follow FBI formatting, and they just look fake. But I don't know. Maybe MJ-12 is real. But if MJ-12,
right, so anyone else looking at, you know, Bashir's Facebook status,
right? But like,
oh man, Section 31. what is that? Ooh, MJ-12.
But like, if MJ-12 is real, then their existence being a secret, or their existence not being a secret, is an accident. They don't intentionally go around revealing themselves to highly respected military officers who are also, you know, genetically enhanced super geniuses who happen to be friends with like Starfleet's A-team. you know,
Space Jesus.
I'm pretty sure that if Majestic 12 is real, they're a little more careful about what they do. For example, what I was going to say is that Section 31 is basically a parallel for the NSA, but like more so, because the NSA is an agency that for a long time was not even publicly recognized. For like I think 10 years after its inception, the government just didn't even acknowledge that the NSA existed. And even
National Security Agency for the United States, for those that don't know what NSA is.
Or no such agency, as it's apparently... I've never heard that one. That's apparently what it's referred to in the in certain circles of the intelligence community.
That's a good one. I like that.
But the NSA, like, I mean, even now, we don't actually know what the NSA does. Like, they say that they're bunch of cryptologists. That's their mission statement. And they have to submit a budget to Congress, which they didn't have to do for a long time. For a long time, they just got whatever money they asked for. But they don't have to say what any of the money is for. They just ask Congress for a set amount of money, and Congress gives it to them. So we have no idea what they're doing with that money.
Buying ice cream. Yeah, all the ice cream.
Probably. So that's basically Section 31, is the idea, is that they are a... although, I guess the big difference is that Section 31 is officially a rogue agency that operates without the, the consent of the Federation, and
which, you know, is strange to say considering that it's in the charter.
Well, yeah, but you know, it's really obscure.
Here's this permission slip saying that you don't have a permission slip from us.
Well, it's like that. It's like the user agreements that you have to click yes to every time you install a piece of software. No one ever reads the whole thing.
That's true. After seeing our Congress in action, I believe that
the Federation, like the Federation Council, when they were first looking over the charter, they were like, "Man, this thing is like 60 pages long. I'm not going to read this whole thing." I mean, I don't know. That's my, it's also possible, they never actually explain exactly what, the Section 31 of the Federation Charter, which is supposedly the thing that creates it, they never actually say what it says. As I understand it, there's like a little subsection.
I think they did in Enterprise.
Did they in Enterprise?
I think so.
I think maybe they explained it as like, basically, like, not actually creating an agency officially.
Well, no, they didn't Enterprise, not because the Federation wasn't a thing yet.
No.
But I remember there was some explanation that was given somewhere at some point in Enterprise dealing with Section 31, I think.
Well, yeah, Section 31 did show up in Enterprise.
Plus, there's, like, several novels that I've read that have, you know, Section 31 mentioned, and, like, the charter thing is right there. It can be found online, too.
Novels, the Star Trek novels really love Section 31.
Oh,
it is everywhere in Star Trek novels.
Yeah, yeah.
It's responsible for so many things. And like Section 31 is really tricky because since they didn't exist in the Star Trek universe until Inquisition, you have to wonder what they were doing at all these various events. Like, you know, the first one that comes to mind is Conspiracy, which is the episode where a bunch of alien bugs are taking over Starfleet.
Mm-hmm.
And like, what was Section 31 doing during that time? What, you know, it's kind of their job to stop this sort of thing from happening.
Maybe they were trying, but they were failing.
I guess. But like the whole thing about it was that all they had to do to make it stop is inform a bunch of non-infected officers that it was going on, because we found out there actually weren't that many of them, of the bugs. Like, they were, you know, they had infected key personnel, but in terms of numbers, they were severely lacking.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there was the captain who informed Picard that the whole thing was going down. I suppose it's possible that Section 31 informed him, but I got the impression that he figured it out just by looking at the weird reports and stuff. And if Section 31 had been working against the bugs and had known the bugs were a thing, it would have been very easy for them to just say, hey, you know, all you loyal Starfleet ships, this is Starfleet Intelligence. They wouldn't even have had to reveal who they were. They could just say, this is Starfleet Intelligence. There's some bugs all up in. Please deal with this.
We have a problem. We can't raid.
Put out like an SOS on that stuff. But, you know, so that's like a, that's, you know, that's a, just a, an oversight, I think. Because I really like Section 31, and I'm glad that they exist, because I think they're really cool, and it makes a lot of sense. But I do think it's funny when you look back at previous episodes. And then, like, Homefront is another really funny one. And that's the one where a Starfleet admiral and his loyal officers are looking to overthrow the civilian government and instate military rule. And it's, like, sort of, I kind of get the implication that Section 31, at the very least, was complacent in that, if not directly behind it. Because I have a hard time believing that the admiral could have gotten all that together without someone in Section 31 knowing about it. But Section 31 did not do anything to stop them. We know Sisko figured it all out on his own. Like, no
well,
one.
I feel Section 31's job might be easier if, in fact, there was a little more of a military hand behind. Well,
see, that's actually my theory, is that I think Section 31 was perfectly happy with that. And I think that Section 31, despite professing to defend Federation values, if given the chance and the opportunity, would institute a much more authoritarian government. Because I feel like you can't drown kittens with one hand and save puppies with the other.
sure I can. Watch.
An organization.
I got two buckets.
You know, there are reasons why the ends aren't supposed to justify the means. And an organization willing to use the underhanded tactics that Section 31 does, for example, genociding an entire race of people on the off chance that we might have to fight them later. Because you have to remember, Section 31 is responsible for the disease that was destroying the Founders. Mm-hmm. And they did that way before there was a Dominion War.
Yep.
They were just like, hey, those guys are mean. We will probably have to fight them at some point. Let's preemptively genocide them. Which, interestingly, didn't work very well. But I guess that was their...
Well, no, it was working fine, but then a cure was developed by Bashir. Not by Bashir.
Yeah, it was
given to him by Sloan when they were running around in his mind.
Yeah, Bashir pretended to already have a cure. Sloan came to get it. And then, you know, Bashir got it from him. Mm-hmm. But what I meant was that it was working very slowly. Because the implication is that Odo was infected at the very latest by Homefront. Because when you were at Starfleet Medical. And we know he was at Starfleet Medical for a significant amount of time during Homefront. Mm-hmm. And of course, I guess the issue is that it had to be a very slow-working virus, because otherwise Odo would die of it before he could infect his people.
Right.
But if it had, you just have to wonder, what would have happened if it had kicked in a little faster, and like the Founders had all died sometime in season 5? That would have been kind of messy.
Rogue Dominion sounds like a fun idea.
Yeah. But you know, I feel like, and I've always been a huge fan of this plot, is that at some point in the future, Section 31, because it's clear that during the Dominion War, Section 31 becomes much more powerful, because suddenly all these Starfleet admirals. At least one, Admiral Ross, are actually working with them and climbing into bed with them, because it's the only way to win the Dominion War. It seems to me that if before Section 31 wasn't super powerful, they certainly were after the Dominion War and after Deep Space Nine. And I imagine it's only really a matter of time until they decided to take over, because there's no oversight. And, you know, to quote a phrase, power corrupts. And there's really no one telling Section 31 that they can't do certain things. And eventually, I think they would just, in the name of protecting the Federation, they would destroy it. And I've always found that to be an interesting plot. It's like, I always thought it'd be really cool if the plot of Voyager had been they get back at the end of the 6th season, and like the Federation is a super authoritarian society that they don't even recognize anymore because they've been gone for so long, and like Section 31 or something equivalent has taken over. Granted, it would be a little weird for a bunch of Deep Space Nine villains to take over Voyager. That would be a little strange. Side note, Seska was a Section 31 agent, was an Obsidian Order agent. And
was she?
Yeah, she was totally an Obsidian Order agent.
Did they say that?
They did.
Oh, okay.
She's an agent of the Obsidian Order, and she is easily the most threatening villain Voyager ever had. She, like, took over the ship armed with nothing but a bunch of Kazon.
Yep.
Which is, you know, basically the equivalent of a wet...
Chakotay's son.
No, not really Chakotay's son. Remember they changed it?
Oh, that's right.
It was originally supposed to be Chakotay's son, but then they realized that there was no way out of the scenario without either giving Chakotay a kid or killing a baby. And you're not allowed to kill babies on television.
Nope.
And they didn't want to have Chakotay with a kid, so they just changed it at the very end. But anyway, that little thing aside, there's also some questions about, like, if Section 31 would have been involved in the Drumhead, the whole, like, drilling of Picard. I'd like to think not, because I think Section 31 probably, you know, keeps enough tabs on Picard that they wouldn't need to.
How would you think that they would be involved?
Well, just because it was a, you know, it was a search. It was like the whole, like the whole point of Drumhead is like, is that there's like this, assuming this Starfleet investigator lady who is willing to compromise free speech.
Admiral Sati.
Admiral Sati, right. Who is willing to compromise free speech and civil liberties in the name of protecting the Federation.
Uh-huh.
Which is totally what Section 31 does. They're just a little more subtle about it. So I thought about it at first, and I was like, you know, maybe the... I was wondering if Section 31 would have been involved in that scenario at all. Like, maybe... I always assumed that with a captain... I've always assumed that Section 31 keeps tabs on all the Starfleet captain, like, all the Enterprise captains because of how, like, crazy and rogue they are.
who's in command of the Enterprise today?
Yeah, who's, you know, what are they out there doing? Especially because the Enterprise is notorious for making decisions that are bad for the Federation in the name of the greater, in the name of, you know, what is right. Although, a quick side note, I forget which novel this is in. Oh, it's in Section 31, The Cloak. It's revealed that...
I love that novel. That's actually my favorite one in Section 31 series.
Really?
Yep.
Well, it's revealed that Kirk finds out about Section 31, and he and some friends form the Kirk Cabal.
They do! Which is like... And it's so great.
The secret society. All right,
guys, there's this, like, thing out there. It's for us, but not for us. Everyone keep your eyes open.
Yeah, it's basically opposed Section 31.
Everyone's kind of like, all right, Kirk, whatever you say, buddy.
I would love to be part of the Kirk Cabal, I have to say. And then, of course, it's not just Section 31 that suffers from the problem of only existing after a certain point. Like, the name Tal Shiar, I don't think that ever came up until Face of the Enemy.
I don't think so either.
But I'm fairly certain they would have had to have been involved in episodes like The Defector, which is the one where Admiral Jarak comes over and is like, hey, the Romulans are totally building a base in the neutral zone. You should stop them before a war happens.
Maybe. I mean, that I felt was probably simple enough. That, you know, just their standard military intelligence could have been involved in that.
Right.
Without going any further. Because their whole plan on that one was just simply to root out if Jarak was a traitor or not.
Right, right. But the reason I think that the Tal Shiar were involved is that the whole thing basically smelled like the Tal Shiar being going after a powerful and well-respected military officer and trying to drive him from grace. Because we see that that's basically...
Was he? Because he already kind of done that to himself anyway.
Well...
If I recall his kind of poor woe is me spiel, where he was like, they're all making these decisions, and I think they're bad decisions, then everybody hates me, is kind of what it boiled down to for Jarak when he was talking to the Enterprise crew.
Yeah, there is. I suppose that is true. But still a respected, if not influential, still a respected military officer. That sounds like something that the Tal Shiar would do to... You know, remind the military who's, you know, what the relationship is here. And I suppose it could have been done without them. But it seems like it just seems like something the Tal Shiar would have their hands in. And then there was Data's Day, where there was the Vulcan ambassador, who turned out to be a Romulan spy. Also fairly certain that was a Tal Shiar agent, even though they never specifically said so.
I can see that.
Alright, and so let's see. Is there any... I think we... Alright, so we've pretty much covered the various intelligence organizations. We've talked a lot about Deep Space Nine. Voyager didn't really have a whole lot of espionage going on, aside from Seska. There wasn't really a whole lot of spying going on in Voyager.
Well, that's because Voyager is not about so much the political and social issues that Deep Space Nine was touting around.
That's true.
Voyager is much more about, you know, like, oh man, these are personal stories, and how do we relate these personal stories to our lives?
That's
what Voyager is all about, which is... Partially the reason I think Voyager was so bad is because they didn't try very hard to relate issues that were happening in society at that time, like Deep Space Nine or TNG did.
No, that's a fact. Now, what I want to know is, was Section 31 involved with the Maquis at all? Was sort of my thought, because, like, you have to wonder, because the Maquis were definitely creating a potential firebomb situation with the Cardassians, and of course, I think the question there would be, the Section 31 think that the Maquis are acting for or against Federation interests?
Oh, against.
Well, I mean, maybe, but there's a lot of...
But the Federation really kind of cut them loose anyway.
Well, later they did. But if you look at, like, especially in...
Maybe Section 31 did that.
Maybe. But if you look at in the episode, Maquis, it's sort of established that there are a number of Federation officials who feel that the treaty was a bad treaty. And it certainly seems like the Cardassians got way more out of it than the Federation did. And it seems like it's a pretty one-sided deal, because the Federation are protecting the Cardassian colonies, and the Cardassians are not protecting the Federation colonies in their territory, and are in fact abusing them. And so it seems like I could totally see Session 31 deciding that in the best interest of the Federation, it would be better to abandon this treaty and you know, force the Cardassians to document a new one. Which might actually explain why it seems like the Maquis were so much better organized than their Cardassian counterparts. Because if you notice, in the first episode with the Maquis, it's like, it's clearly Maquis who are the Federation civilians versus Cardassian civilians. And then you have the governments on both sides being like, what are we going to do about this?
Right.
And we find out that the Central Command is arming its civilians, but they're not actually militarily involved. And then later, it's the Maquis versus the Cardassian military, as opposed to just a bunch of Cardassian militias.
Right.
But the Maquis are somehow still able to hold it together, and we never actually see any indication of what happened to their Cardassian civilian counterparts.
It's because they're using Bridge Commander Peregrines.
Oh, yeah, they are. Sorry, inside joke. But it would explain why, if Section 31 was discreetly helping the Maquis, it would explain why they were so much better organized.
I don't think Section 31 would get involved with something that overt, I think.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of that was explained through, simply stealing stuff and conducting a really smart guerrilla, you know, action against Cardassians.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because that's what we see.
Yeah.
Right?
That is true. I mean, I guess the question in the back of my mind was always like, you know.
Because the Maquis certainly don't have any hardware that could stand up against the Galar class cruiser.
Well.
They just don't. Well, I mean, aside from Bridge Commander. But I mean.
But like, the Maquis are fairly.
They can outrun them, they can hit them real quick, you know, take supplies where they need to, things like that.
Well, I mean, apparently three Maquis raiders, if they have the element of surprise on their side, can clean the clock of an Excelsior class starship.
Well, that was an elaborate trap, from what I understand, relayed by Eddington in the first place.
Well, I mean, what happened was that they Eddington put down a decoy that when the Excelsior ship got close, it, like, blasted them with something that knocked out their shields and confused all their sensors. But it didn't actually damage the ship, that, from what I understood.
Their nacelle was leaking.
Right, but that was from the Maquis raiders, because the ship was knocked senseless for a few minutes. And then the Maquis attacked while they were getting all their stuff back together.
Uh-huh.
Maquis raiders do pack a fairly substantial punch. I mean, they're still, like, you know, small ships, and they obviously can't stand up to a large warship. But, you know, this is fairly heavy-duty hardware for a bunch of farmers who decided they were going to be terrorists.
True.
I mean, you know, this is kind of like if Al-Qaeda was tooling around in, like, you know, Sherman tanks. Like, you know, they can't take on an Abrams, but they're still, like, pretty significant military hardware.
They still have a cannon on it that can put holes in things.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. That was always the question in the back of my mind was where are the Maquis getting these ships? Because they, as we see, they move up from the little Peregrines to like these much larger raider ships, and they must be getting them from somewhere.
I think it's just them being smart. Yeah. I really honestly think that. And then Starfleet sympathizers getting them hardware where they can.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Or Maquis sympathizers from Starfleet, excuse me.
Right, exactly.
And then there's always, you know, the outside trading that they probably do, you know.
Yeah.
Not everything they get is going to be from the Federation, necessarily. I mean, the Ferengi are nearby.
Yeah, that's right? True. Be like, Ferengi, we will give you stuff if you will give us weapons. It's like, I wonder what they are giving the Ferengi. Apparently they have latinum. I wasn't really sure where they were getting that latinum from.
Who, the Maquis?
Yeah. Like, in the first episode, they actually arrange with Quark to buy a bunch of weapons. And they're like, I'm going to pay, and the Vulcan lady is like, I'm going to pay in latinum. They're like, where did you get that latinum? They don't have latinum on Federation colonies. Where's that latinum from, lady?
So where are you getting your funds?
All right, but we're on a bit of a tangent. Before we run out of time, I wanted to talk a little bit about why, like, how espionage episodes work in terms of a story. And as you were just talking about, the reason why we see a lot of espionage in both The Next Generation, but then mainly Deep Space Nine, is that those episodes were about, like, the relationships of, like, nations, as it were, and, like, the political dramas between them.
Mm-hmm.
And espionage...
Deep Space Nine more so.
Yeah, definitely. And espionage episodes work great for that sort of thing because they... For one thing, they introduce an immediate danger. There's always the threat of discovery when you're doing an espionage mission.
Right.
Or the threat of an unknown enemy you're trying to discover if you reverse the roles with the changelings. And so that's immediately a threatening situation and creates a lot of drama right off the bat. And it's also perfect for moral ambiguity because very often, as Section 31 demonstrates, the intelligence world calls for doing stuff that, you know, to get the job done that are not, you know, they're not pleasant and go against your morals. And we, I mean, heck, we can, there's all kinds of examples of that just in the regular world, which I don't want to get into too much.
But this is exhaustive.
Yeah. But, you know, it creates a very interesting, like, moral dilemma very easily. It doesn't, you know, it lends itself very well to Deep Space Nine style of storytelling, especially with Deep Space Nine and their whole humans aren't just perfect. Because, you know,
they can be dicks.
Yeah, humans can be assholes. And I honestly always found that much more poignant than the idea that humans were just better in the future. I prefer to think that humans still have all the same flaws that they used to, but they have grown to the point where they are able to overcome them, as opposed to some examples where they just don't have those flaws anymore. Which is, you know, and that
Thank you, Replicator.
Yeah.
You're a boon to my existence.
Gosh darn Replicators. Oh, and I forgot. I wanted to mention Inter Arma Silent Legis just real quick, because that's a really good episode in general. But it also just showed how much better Section 31 was than other intelligence agencies. Because that whole episode is basically Section 31 is just pulling the Tal Shiar strings. Like, the head of the Tal Shiar is apparently a Section 31 like sleeper agent or what have you. And it's like, wait, really? The head of the Tal Shiar? God, I guess the Tal Shiar must be noobs. And I was just like, I wonder how did they swing that? Like, I have to wonder, what could they possibly be offering him to make him, like, be willing to betray the Tal Shiar, which he is the head of? Like,
well, do you read a lot of Tom Clancy or anything like that?
No.
Okay. So in a lot of the kind of spy intrigue espionage stories that I read, you know, obviously the intelligence communities are working against each other, but more often than not, they will actually work together sometimes to benefit each other in some way. You know, so I would, you know, put forth the, you know, theory anyway, that maybe the head of the Tal Shiar perhaps maybe isn't a sleeper agent so much as, like, you know, they needed the Romans to get involved in the war, and then they gave the Tal Shiar some favor of some sort.
So you think it's more of a trade? It's like,
yeah,
it's like, hey, we will help, because in that episode, the whole,
because espionage and, like, you know, intrigue and cloak and dagger is not as clear cut as I have my army versus your army.
Oh, that's true.
It's much more, I want to be at this place, you want to be at this place. I wonder what I can do to get myself here before you get here, or maybe we can get to these places together.
Making, you know, a lot of fancy hand motions
here. As long as they're not, you know, opposing, obviously.
Well, that would make sense, because the point of the episode is, basically that Section 31 is trying to get this guy who's the head of the Tal Shiar onto the Continuing Committee, which is, like, the biggest, most powerful body in the Romulan government. And they end up manipulating Bashir into discrediting his big rival, who was, like, this awesome senator lady.
Mm-hmm.
And I could totally see the Section 31 going to the Tal Shiar guy and being like, hey, if we help you get onto the Continuing Committee, you owe us. And, you know, or, you know, you owe us some kind of favor of some kind.
Yep.
So that would make sense. That would make more sense than him just being in their pocket, which is what I originally thought the implication was. Because, like, what could they possibly have on him to make him do that?
I mean, the episode definitely presents itself if you don't have that kind of deeper understanding of, you know, how the, at least as far as, like, fiction goes, you know, how it works in the real world. I'm not a spy. As far as, like, fiction goes, it's definitely very much where, like, all these intelligence communities, they very much communicate with each other, and if they can, you know, help someone else to help themselves, you know, to where, like, I want to advance my position or my power structure to this place, and you need to get somewhere, and I need something of yours, I can help you with this, they're not above doing that at all.
Right.
You know, because it's all about, like, you know, I need to get here, this is my goal, I need to finish this goal, I need to make this goal happen. How can I get there the fastest way possible?
If television has taught me anything about intelligence networks, it's that they have, like, five guys in them. Because, like, I'm thinking of MI5, which is a British television show that I stopped watching after a while just because they kept killing off characters and replacing them with less cooler versions of themselves. But that show is just kind of funny because there are, like, a total of, like, five people who seem to be doing all of MI5's job.
MJ-12's job.
Oh, dear, MJ-12. It's infiltrated all things Trek. But it's, you know, there are, like, five people doing all of MI5's job. And it's, like, that seems like a little understaffed, guys.
That's a pretty inaccurate
well, like, that's
representation
not
the, of what MI5 would be.
Yeah,
MI5 is military intelligence.
Yeah, for, I mean, you know, I don't think that was the intention. I think it was just that, like, you know, like they have their big star agent like going after like on this one case that was like some little domestic like homegrown terrorism thing. And I was like, really? You're going to send your big main agent on this? This is like, compared to all your other stories, this isn't really that big a deal. Do you not have someone else to deal with this problem? And like, we never heard of any other problems other than the ones the main characters were dealing with. Which is interesting, because I never got that idea. I never got that feeling when I'm looking at Star Trek intelligence, you know, shows about, you know, spying and stuff. I always get the implication that there are other agents in other places doing other jobs. But in the MI5 show, it really feels like these are the only people doing any kind of spying in Britain. But anyway, I think we've about run the course on intelligence. Do you have anything else you wanted to say?
No.
Other than make some more intelligence jokes?
Oh, snap.
Oh, darn. So next week, we are going to be talking about the first episode of each Star Trek series.
Bum, bum, bum.
Which will be interesting, considering some of them. But... I hope to see you then. This is
a lot of hate.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what.
That is going to be a lot of rage. So, you know, don't...
How do you want to handle the original series on that?
Well, we'll do both. We'll do The Cage and whatever the other one is called.
The Man Trap?
Yeah, The Man Trap. All right. So anyway, we'll see you next week. This is All Things Trek signing off.